have everyone. Welcome to tonight's class, the last in our series on the history of halakha. This is, of course, is acting sort of as a pre-introduction of sorts to our year course next year, Halakha B'Shana. We're going to talk about the way the halakhic system works, a bit more systematically break it down, different topics, different areas, and so on, which I think is going to be really, I'm excited about it, and I think it's going to be really interesting for everyone as well. The registration for that, I hope, will be up and running over the next week or so. Normally, basically the way it's going to work is the course is free for anyone that wants to attend. If anybody wants to get access to classes that they miss, you want to get the course binder, things of that nature, so for that I'm asking for registration. Registration is going to be $50 for members of the synagogue, $75 for people that are not members. But I'm going to have like a little grace period at the beginning for anyone that wants to sign up at the $50 rate. So anyone can do that. So if you've been in the classes, you'll sort of know to sign up early and get the savings. The course is going to start the very end of October, very beginning of November. It's like October 31st, something like it's a Tuesday. It's November 1st. That we just got. Okay, fine. So it's going to be thanks. It's going to be November 1st. It'll be the first. It'll be Tuesday nights, also 7 to 8. So if you want, shoot me an email, you know, asking me, oh, when is it up or whatever, and I'll let you know. But I think sometime this week it's going to be up to do the registration. And then to do that, you'll go to this website, CSI, for Congregation Share with Israel, CSILearning.com. And through there, .com, and through that you'll be able to access... It may be stuff from this past year. I don't think, maybe it's up already, I just don't know yet, but I know it's in the process this week of that kind of stuff getting uploaded. So, and that, there'll be a link on there to a constant contact page where you'll be able to sign up and pay and do everything online, so it'll be really easy. So just be in touch with me, look out for it. That should be. Yeah, there's like a course binder that I hand out, and then for you to keep all your sheets in together. You know, I mean, you buy it on your, just a binder on your own also if you want. But whatever, I prepare a binder. And then the main thing is just being get access to classes that you miss, because I'm not going to be uploading classes. So if you feel like, oh, you know what, who can make it to 20 classes? You're only going to make it to 15 of them, but you don't want to miss out. So this way you can do it. So it's more of just like a nominal fee to, for the work involved in putting it together. Yeah. Okay. Enough on that. Last week, we spoke about the what's considered to be the most authoritative code. We spent a lot of time talking about different codes of halakha over the past number of weeks. So last week, we finally spoke about the Shulchan Aruch, which is written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in the 16th century, and spoke about how... What we're going to talk about today is how authoritative it is, but what we spoke about last week was what made it unique. One of the things that he did differently was that there was this constant battle about, do you write a code of law which is very direct, specific, just this is what you do without all the complicated explanations and debates and so on one hand, which gives it the benefit of clarity, but it has the weakness that perhaps it's not entirely clear if you don't explain the reasoning, or perhaps there's different opinions. And one of the great things about Jewish tradition is that we have as part of our tradition the fact that there are different opinions on different matters, and depending on the situation, so then it determines which position you'll follow, or depending on the circumstance, or the based on the reasoning of the rabbi, and so on. And so a source that doesn't incorporate those things or doesn't explain how you reach that conclusion based on the Talmudic debates sometimes leaves something to be wanting. We spoke about that's really why the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, which is a beautiful code, never really made it, because he didn't have that aspect to his work. On the other hand, if you write a code that gives a background, shows all the debates, all the reasoning, all the discussions, by the time you get to the end of it, you're so confused. It stops being a useful tool for a person who wants to just know what the halakha is. So Rabbi Yosef Karo came up with the idea. He wrote a commentary on the Torah, which spoke about was a well-organized book. That was the first person who, Yaakov Ben Asher, who organized into four separate categories, the Orachaim, Ibn Ezer, Yoredeya, Choshen Mishpat, and following his debate, he went on and he did all the discussions and the elaboration and exploration of the reasoning behind the laws and the different debates over the centuries and so on. Then, based on his conclusions, he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. So if you want to just get sort of the succinct decision, look in there. But if you want to understand the basis for that decision, to really perhaps more fully understand that decision, you can look into his Beit Yosef and find there all those explanations. We then spoke about how Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who was living in Krakow, also decided to write a commentary on the Torah. Shulchan Aruch came out first. He decided, well, I'm not going to write a whole thing. I'll just add whatever I think basically Rabbi Yosef Karo left out in his Beit Yosef. He adds additional comments in that in his commentary on the Torah. And then he also, instead of writing a whole code of law similar to the Shulchan Aruch, he just made glosses to the Shulchan Aruch wherever he felt that he should have incorporated different positions, or perhaps he disagreed with the conclusion, or felt that perhaps Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't discuss a particular matter, so he made a little gloss and added that in. And so together, the Shulchan Aruch, the set table with the mapah, with the tablecloth, together, right, became this code, which became usable for both Sfaradim, for Ashkenazim. It incorporates a lot of different laws. If you want to understand the laws better, you can always look back in there, in their more elaborate discussions written on the tour, and there you can see their explanations. So that was the writing of their code. Now, despite the fact that it did something different, that it was a great work, it reflected Sephardic Ashkenazi traditions, there, as there always has been the case, there always is a certain hesitancy against any code book. Anytime you write a law book, there's going to be people who disagree with certain conclusions. People who just disagree with the general sense that, hey, you wrote a law book, and always that fear that law books will become the basis for the law as opposed to just simply the expression of the law, and that people will misunderstand a succinct comment in a law book, and through that, we'll end up making erroneous conclusions, and therefore felt uncomfortable with it. With the Shulchan Aruch, there was the added problem of his methodology for reaching conclusions. Right, and this we spoke about, that the way that Rabbi Yosef Karo decided he would conclude what the halakha should be, he says, who am I to put my head between two mountains, meaning who am I to decide the law between the great rabbis who came before me. He says that we could do it, but the amount of time and effort it would take to reach those conclusions, we never actually finish the process. And so he says, what we're going to do is, we're going to take majority rule, and the majority rule is going to be based on three leading rabbis, the Rambam, the Rif, Rabbeinu Alfasi, and Rabbeinu Asher, known as the Rosh. And I'll take the majority rule in a situation where maybe all three of them don't discuss it, only two of them discuss it, so then we'll have a second bench of rabbis to look towards, and through that is how we'll reach a conclusion about what the halakha should be. As you might imagine, a lot of people responded, they said, what kind of, we never heard anything like that in our lives, that's not the way, who are, first of all, why those three, and that's not the base for decisions. Usually decisions are based on the more recent rabbis, their rulings act as greater precedent than a rabbi from 500 years ago. What kind of process is that for deciding things? So the process for, we'll talk about within the Ashkenazi community, there was resistance within the Sephardic community as well, but that seems to have evaporated within a generation or so. When people refer to the Shulchan Aruch, when they refer to Rabbi Yosef Karo, he's often referred to as Maran. If you ever hear people, Sephardic Jews referred to, they'll always say, oh, Maran says this, Maran says that. That's how they refer. Why is he called Maran? So I never knew. I recently found this. It's an acronym for Matayim Rabbanim Nismach, that 200 rabbis agreed. Apparently, there's this tradition that at some point in the generation afterwards, the 200 Sephardic rabbis basically agreed, we will follow with the conclusion of the Shulchan Aruch. And so in a sense, when you follow him, you're not following two out of three, you're really following 200, right? 200 rabbis sort of agreed with the conclusion of the Shulchan Aruch. Matayim, Rabbanim, Nismach. 200 rabbis agreed, Maran. And so since really that point, in general, the conclusions of the Shulchan Aruch have been accepted as authoritative within the Sephardic community. The question is, what about within the Ashkenazic community? Rabbeinu Asher, sometimes referred to as the Rosh, the Rosh. Okay. So as I mentioned, there was this initial reaction, particularly among the generation that lived at that time, the rabbis who were alive. You know, it's like we think now Shulchan Aruch of like this sacred text. They were there, you know. It's like the rabbi down the street published a book, and a lot of them didn't like it. They said, we're not in favor in general of writing code books. This majority rule thing is like, on the basis of what should that be, how we render decisions? They felt, again, the fact that there's no sources quoted in it. And they also felt that as part of that notion of no sources, that sometimes the language is not entirely clear. Anytime you make a statement, you open yourself up to interpretation. And as much as the author of any particular text might think that, no, they're using a succinct, precise language, there's always going to be different ways of looking at a word that you use. And unless you understand the whole background behind what somebody is saying, it's going to be difficult to understand them. And on one hand, there's this other book. So look in the Beit Yosef and see what it says there, and you'll understand what he means in the Shulchan Aruch. So there were some understood inconsistencies between Beit Yosef and Shulchan Aruch. There was a question about maybe he had changed his mind when he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. We know that he had written some edits to the Beit Yosef that were lost, so it could be that in the Beit Yosef there was a sense that it's a difficult process. You have two separate books. You got to look in this book, then you look in that book. Is everyone really looking in the Beit Yosef to see what it says? Or you have a separate book, the Shulchan Aruch, which is clear-cut law. You're just looking in that. Who's opening up the Beit Yosef? Not to mention, Beit Yosef, it's very long-winded. It's very elaborate. It's great. It's a beautiful work. But it takes a lot of effort to read it. So unless someone is a great, you know, is a real scholar, are they necessarily really going through that? And there was just this general, seems to be, in Ashkenazi communities, within Poland and so on, a general hesitancy against this kind of codification of law. There was a greater sense of, halachic independence, that rabbis should have greater individual authority or autonomy over their halachic decisions. And all of a sudden, you write a code book, and all of a sudden, I disagree. But now there's like the sense I've got to follow what the book says because the book was published. So in general, there was like a general hesitancy away from this whole kind of codification process. Despite the fact that Rabbi Moshe Israelitz wrote this gloss that incorporated, you know, some Ashkenazi traditions as well, and, you know, and made it, therefore, a text that would be meaningful to both Ashkenazim and Sephardim. So in the 16th century, there really is this initial kind of rejection of the usage of the Shulchan Aruch. It's not accepted. Now today it is a very accepted text. The question is, what happened? Right, what was this process through which all of a sudden Shulchan Aruch was looked to as a more important text? So the process of its acceptance happens through the 17th, and I would say like the first half or so of the 18th century. And that's what I want to talk about exactly why. So one of the major reasons for its acceptance is the usage of commentary. You know, like, there's always more commentaries to write a book, and everyone has to make commentaries on that, right? We've seen this over and over again. It's like a cycle. So a number of rabbis wrote, in a sense, almost like a response to the Shulchan Aruch. And in there they say, oh, we disagree with that point. Or the reasoning behind his particular statement is based on that source. Or there is an additional custom that he was not aware of that we want to make people know. And all of a sudden, around the Shulchan Aruch, developed these set of commentaries that, in a sense, made the Shulchan Aruch a more a broader kind of text. Right? All of a sudden, it wasn't just the specific ruling of Rabbi Yosef Karo as he understood it, but you could read what the Shulchan Aruch says, and then see, oh, this is what the Siftei Kohen, the Shach, as he's referred to, says on the side of the page. And oh, he tells me something, an Ashkenazi approach that the Shulchan Aruch does not reflect. Or he explains to me this seemingly odd statement in the Shulchan Aruch. He actually tells me why it makes a lot of sense. So all of a sudden, I don't have to go to another book, this very elaborate, involved text, the Beit Yosef, that Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote as well. But I can open up my Shulchan Aruch, and I can look on the side of the page for an explanation of the law. I can look on the side of the page if there's any other, perhaps, position that the Shulchan Aruch did not incorporate. And all of a sudden, it's not that the Shulchan Aruch itself becomes the be-all and end-all, but the Shulchan Aruch, with the commentaries that surround it, that can be found within the same collection together, that as a whole makes it a very useful text. Right? All of a sudden, it's centered around one place that allows it to be more than just what it would have been of itself. So today, if you pull off the shelf a volume of the Shulchan Aruch, it's a very big book, you open it up, in the middle is a little bit of text and a lot of words all around it. Right, and all those words around it are basically what's helped give it such lasting quality, because it basically started as the jumping point. And that's sort of what's significant about, for better or for worse, it's now the starting point. Right, the starting point, in a sense, is not the Talmud. If I have a halakhic question, I'm not going to say, well, let me go look, see what it says in the tractate of Kiddushin or in the tractate of Pesachim. I'm going to look what it says in the Shulchan Aruch as my starting point. And then I'll see, what does this commentary say? What does that commentary say? Is there something else that I need to think of besides what the Shulchan Aruch says? But that has become the starting point, right? That has become the new code. Yes, you'll look back at the Talmud, you want to understand the debates, the sugya, and so on. When it comes to law, for the most part, it's become the place that the discussion begins. Not necessarily where it ends. Oftentimes not where it ends, but it is sort of where the conversation starts. Yeah.
The last commentaries that they incorporated on the frame as it were to the Shulchan Aruch, you're saying, was in the early part of the 18th century?
Yeah, into the 18th century.
Now, was there some sort of an agreement that this will be, in essence, a closed book at this point? Or was there any entertainment of the idea that there should be further additions that would continue to
grow? So I'm going to talk about that. It's a great question. The question is, what's happened since? So we'll talk about that. Another important thing, which is made, which perhaps is part of the eventual acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch, is, and this is one of the things we've looked at, there's sort of two moments in time that perhaps somebody writes a law book. Right, you're going to write a law book when all of a sudden, since the last law book, there's been so much written that I need a new book that incorporates all of those things. So that certainly was the case with the Shulchan Aruch. It had been a couple hundred years since the Torah was written. Right, so it does that. But one of the other times that you might write a law book is after a time of disaster, right? When everything is in disarray, and there's a sense that we need to regroup. And certainly within Ashkenazi Jewry, that occurred in the 17th century with the what's called the Chalmniki massacres that happened, I believe, in 1648, 1649, where perhaps a few hundred thousand Jews were killed by the Cossacks, which was a huge. I mean, we're used to hearing 6 million, so anything that's not, but first of all, just in and of itself, obviously 300,000 is a huge number. But also, when you think of the community, is obviously much smaller than it eventually was. You know, at the time of the Shoah, it was a huge disaster. It was disastrous. It was terrible. It happened throughout communities in Russia, Poland, and it was very terrible. It was a terrible uprising. led by the peasants against the upper class. The Jews tend to be sort of associated with that class. They were protected, right? Jews in any place that they lived in, this is going to refer to some things we're going to talk about, but basically Jews couldn't live anywhere in Europe unless they were given the privilege to live there. But in a sense, part of that privilege also meant that they were there under the authority or protection of the ruling class. So on one hand, that's great. You're under the, you know, the protection of the ruling class. On the other hand, when people get upset at the ruling class, they also tend to associate Jews as the lackeys or whatever of the of that ruling class. So as part of these revolts, Jews were severely persecuted. And so it seems perhaps as also as a result of that, perhaps enabled Shulchan Aruch to succeed, particularly because the, even on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, there are commentaries on that that sort of do what the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch do, and yet the Rambam's work never made it. So it could be, you know, some historical pressure also facilitated the fact that this code ended up being a code that became universally accepted as the starting point for any conversation on Jewish law.
What was the name of the massacre?
The it's called the Chelmniki massacres.
How do you spell?
C H E L M
N
I K I, something like that. Yeah. You're welcome. Okay. What's also interesting is sort of like a result of this dominance of the Shulchan Aruch is that even other texts that have been written since then that aren't commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch will tend to be organized according to the organizational structure of the Shulchan Aruch. So if I'm going to, let's say I'm a rabbi that writes responsa, and I, you know, have my responsa on, you know, my, you know, 90 different topics, and, you know, I've written 300 letters, you know, dealing with a whole variety of halachic things, and then somebody wants to collect it and publish it in a book, they're going to collect and organize them based on the organization of the Shulchan Aruch. So there's going to be four sections to it. They're going to have be titled. Perhaps they'll before each responsa, they'll actually identify which siman in the Shulchan Aruch this topic is discussed, right? And it will be clearly organized in that way, which basically means, which is helpful, because if I'm looking at this responsa and I want to look and say, oh, well, I want to open what Shulchan Aruch says about this and what the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch say, so it would be very easy to go back and forth. But it shows the influence that really all the texts are organized that way. And even, oftentimes, even if people have written independent codes, law books, at the time of the Shulchan Aruch, they tend to still organize them the way that the Shulchan Aruch is organized. The only time you find it not done that way is when you have, and this is something that's pretty popular today, is where you don't find you know, a book which is everything. You'll find books that are, you know, a book on the laws of Shabbat or a book on the laws of Pesach. So there, it's just the book in of itself, inside of it, the internal organization of the book won't necessarily be the organization of the laws of Pesach as you'll find them in the Shulchan Aruch. But when people tend to do broader, more comprehensive halachic organizations, it tends to all be organized based on the Shulchan Aruch, which facilitates easy comparison and study between all the different books that we're talking about. Because you do find a lot of responsa literature that are written then throughout this time period, but certainly then into the 1800s and so on, that becomes more a huge outpouring of responsa literature. Certainly as the world changes and modernity and science, right, there's this huge development of responsa. There's always been responsa literature, but it becomes even more because all of a sudden there's all these new situations never been directly discussed in the Shulchan Aruch, right, as you'd expect, that require clarification. You know, how do you build a subway in Manhattan with an elevated train? Does the elevated train count as a wall for building your A-roof? So Moshe Feinstein has to write a response on that. I mean, all these credits, like, no one would have thought about it 400 years ago kind of thing, you know? And so they have to look back and say, well, are there principles of the law that can be applied to these situations and can direct us, can govern us on how to deal with these new situations, right? And that's what the literature is about, and that's sort of part of things we'll talk about in next year's classes. You know, how does that process work? How do you evaluate? How do you make decisions? What are the different principles that are taken into account when making halakhic decisions and so on? That's what we'll talk about next year, but those are the things that are going to happen a lot as we move into the modern period. What I want to talk about, so we sort of brought ourselves up into the 18th century. There's a huge shift that occurs within the world of halakha, on the literature of halakha at this point, right? Starting in the middle, late of the 18th century. Prior to this time, this thing we spoke about in the past, right? The community was involved, was organized as a kihilah. Or we call ourselves today Kihilat Kodesh, right? A holy community. But there, the Kihilah was actually almost like a legal term. As I mentioned, Jews lived in places throughout the world, tended to govern themselves. They were given permission to live in a particular area. They paid a tax to the local authority, but they weren't expected to follow the laws of the land. No, you're Jews, you're going to follow Jewish law. And so communities tend to be self-governed, right? And that's why, for instance, in olden times, the cheirim, the excommunication, was such a powerful tool because there was no place else to go. You're part of the Jewish community. You wouldn't be a Jew and just not be in the Jewish community. You had to be. So it was, if you were authorized in the Jewish community, you basically were totally on your own, right? Today, you use excommunication, the person just goes to the synagogue down the street. It's a much weaker kind of tool, and that's why in general it's fallen out of popularity, because it's just silly to issue them unless it's some kind of extreme circumstance. And that's basically the way it worked. We governed ourselves. And so in all matters of law, we governed it ourselves, and we opened up the law books, and we had entire law books, right? Choshen Mishpah, which deals with civil law. We have code books to deal with marital issues, right? All these different laws. Our law books talk about them, right? They're in the Torah. Right? We used to have a country, right, in the land of Israel, and we had a government, and so it governed all of society. So we have laws that tell us how to govern ourselves. And so even though we weren't in the land of Israel, we continued to operate under the government. It'd be like living in America following Chinese law because you're from China. Right? That's basically what we did, right? We took our laws and we continued to follow them wherever we went, right?
And were there separate Jewish courts at that time?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The whole thing. The Beit Din, we governed ourselves from it. Doesn't mean there weren't certain types of things which maybe the Thar. Generally speaking, we governed ourselves. And we were responsible to govern ourselves. It wasn't just like it wasn't a privilege. It was a responsibility. It was like, you guys better take care of your own problems or else we're going to get you, you know, you're not going to be welcome here, basically. Yeah, well, Italy gets a little more complicated. Yeah. Italy, there was more, but let's say in Poland, yeah, yeah. No, there's a whole. We'll look at this in the coming year. You know, there's a whole set of literature. What if it's between a Jew and a non-Jew? So how do you deal with that? Or what if the two Jews want to go to a non-Jewish court? There's all these laws that deal with that. But as a basic rule, that's the way things were governed. That all changes during emancipation. Emancipation is this time that Jews are given, they're recognized by the state as citizens of the state. We're not a separate kind of permitted community. We're citizens like anyone else. The country isn't a religious country. It's a country that has citizens, and those citizens can be any religion that they want to be. Maybe the country has a religion that's the state religion, but it doesn't impact the status of its citizens. You're a citizen regardless. One of the results of that is that you're now a citizen of the state. You're required to follow the laws of the state. And if you break the laws of the state is going to prosecute you. And in fact, and we'll have a class devoted to this topic next this coming year, in fact, halakha recognizes the authority of the state when it comes to civil matters, When it comes to business affairs, halakha actually recognizes that if you live in a country and those are the laws of the land, and it's a country which is grounded on laws, meaning it's not like, you know, they have laws for when they want to keep them, but meaning it's a country of laws, then when it comes to business dealings, in fact, those do govern what even the law should be for a Jew. And we'll talk more about exactly how that works during the year. But what that basically meant was that entire aspects of Jewish law, Jews didn't really need to think about anymore. Right, a whole section, the Shulchan Aruch, of right, this Choshen Mishpat, that was civil laws. You know, when you're dealing with a business deal, you're not thinking about like, oh, let me check to see what halakha says about that. You check to see, you know, what, can I do this business deal? Am I, is embezzling money? Am I going to be prosecuted? I mean, that's the process that we go through. So to some extent, this whole kind of civil, or what maybe we call secular, in a sense, kinds of laws stop being a focus for Jewish communities anymore. And the focus is entirely on what maybe we would call religious or ritual law. Right? I would say, pushing forward the sense that we have now of Judaism as a religion, which it's not. Judaism is a country. Right? So there's a country that had laws, and as citizens of that country, we've continued to perform those laws. But because we don't really do the civil laws the way that we used to, now we tend to see ourselves like a religion that has more religious kinds of things to it. But that's not really what Judaism is. But that's sort of what it's become as a result of this. And you can see this in the kinds of literature that have been written since that time. One of the popular law books that's been written since that time is called the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the abridged Shulchan Aruch. It wasn't written by Rabbi Yosef Karo. It was written by Rabbi, I believe, in the 18th century. And it's not an abridgment of the whole Shulchan Aruch. It's only an abridgment of the laws that have primarily religious laws, day-to-day, you know, Shabbat, holidays. It deals with laws of kosher and some basics of marriage. But when it comes to civil laws, it barely even talks about them, right? That stopped being a focus of halakhic literature. And in general, it seems to stem like an extent of sort of the creativity, the focus, the analysis of those kinds of laws. I spoke about that today in Israel. There's this movement called Mishpat Ivri, which is to figure out how would halakha apply in a modern state, particularly these civil kinds of matters. And there's been this process to now go back and to kind of re-engage those texts, to understand them and to consider them, because to some extent, and there's always been rabbis who studied them, we've always had Jewish courts for Jews that decided to have their cases of between Jews adjudicated by Jewish law. Rabbis have always been familiar, you know, with those things, but it hasn't been an intensive kind of study as we moved into modernity. That's sort of like a newer kind of thing to re-engage that, particularly within a modern state of Israel.
Does Mishpat Ivri influence the current judges in Israel, or is it independent of the current courts?
You know, I think it's independent. At this point, the government in Israel operates under British law, right? Common law. So I don't think it really does. Do they take into consideration Jewish values? If they take Jewish values into consideration, but when I don't think they're the way they categorize the laws and so on. I'm not an expert in the field. I don't think it does. I think it's more of an academic pursuit at this point. I think so. Okay. Any questions? No? Okay. So let's... So I want to talk a little bit, just because I feel like we've been dancing around some of these topics for a while, so it's worth it to talk about it a little bit, about Psak, about how we reach legal decisions. I'm not going to get into it really in depth now, but just sort of like some broad kind of takeaways maybe that that we've had from the things that we've spoken about. And in that, we'll talk about sort of approaches in Pesach, but also a little bit about the halachic community today, which we're part of the history. So it's good. Pesach, which means rendering a legal decision. The person who makes the decision is often referred to as a posek. Right? The posek is the one who's making a pesach. Say that. Then that's right. Okay. Yeah.
Perhaps theoretical, I don't know.
Sure.
When we think of Jewish law, we always think of the rulings come from people who are imbued in the religious life. Okay? Can somebody who is not a practicing Jew write Jewish law that is like, this is amazing? Would somebody who is religious then be an advocate for that type of response? Or is it like, oh, the person is nishgut? Is there ever an idea that somebody who is not themselves blood kosher, as we say?
Listen, I think you certainly see that, you know. Something won't be adopted. I mean, something has to have authority to it. So if something's not written by someone themselves, does, you know, the activities, I imagine though, there will be always a certain suspicion of it. But listen, anytime you write something, you know, who knows what kind of influence it ultimately has if it's sound.
Is there ever a question, like, for example, when you spoke about the Mishpat Ivri, you said that in Israel now it's more of an academic pursuit. Now, it might be an academic pursuit, strictly within people within the yeshiva, but when you think of something being academic, then in another type of institution, a person can be a scholar, but not necessarily,
religiously observant. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, my guess is that most of the people who are involved in this tend to be more the observant community.
Of course, no,
that's my expectation. Listen, if I'm personally not a scholarly person, I'm not going to follow it if it's not coming from someone who I trust. So, does it mean that it may have some influence among the scholars? Because if I'm a scholar, I'll look at it and I'll say, oh, you know what, even though that person's not observant, what they say actually makes a lot of sense. And then, if I choose to say it, so then, but if I'm a person who doesn't know, right?
Yes.
So, and some professor says, oh, this is what the law should be, but my rabbi says it's not the case, I'm not going to, I mean, you know, so.
Thank you.
I can't really answer. I mean, I'm just.
No. I was reading about, in Israel, one of the chief judges or ex. You know,
Menachem Elon.
Yeah, is looking into that.
So he's saying, his book is basically what wrote our course this summer. So, no, but I think he's a religious Jew also. So, in addition to having been Supreme Court, part of the Supreme Court.
If someone is not observant of a particular code of law, why should their opinions have any weight in terms of what people would do? If an American lawyer was disbarred.
Yeah, I don't think it would.
Why would that lawyer be writing law?
Again, I don't think it would have direct influence, but again, anytime somebody writes something, other people will think about what you say and then evaluate for themselves what they want to do. But you're right, it won't be like a direct result. But let's talk a little bit about different kind of methods that we've seen about Pesach, I think, during this course. So one approach that we saw sort of originally, sort of this position that was reflected on, why do we choose the Babylonian Talmud over the Jerusalem Talmud? Right? The Babylonian Talmud is the Talmud that's most often discussed and studied. So why is that? And you know what we spoke about? Why that one is considered more authoritative? Sorry? Anyone? Why the Babylonian Talmud went out? Because it was later. There's a comment in the Talmud that says Hilchata Kibatrai, that the law follows the later. Because if I'm later, then I've heard everything before, I've considered it, and if I reach a different conclusion, then it must be that I choose to follow a different opinion. So okay, it's because I considered both opinions, and that's the opinion I thought was better. So if the Jerusalem Talmud thought a different opinion was the right opinion, so obviously Babylonian Talmud disagreed. And they knew what the Jerusalem Talmud said and disagreed anyway. So that gives them authority. Yeah. Sorry? So that's basically, normally we find that we'll follow an Amora. A Tana has, let's say, greater authority. But my understanding is that there tends to be more of a sense of not binding. It's not a Tana's person who wrote the Mishnah versus an Amora or the rabbis of the Talmud. The rabbis of the Mishnah come earlier, generally speaking, within the Talmud. If a Tana said something, an Amora doesn't disagree. Oh, a Tana said it? Conversation over. Which would seem to go against this idea. So my understanding is that that tends to be more of a sense of reverence than it is about actual law. Meaning an Amora could disagree with a Tana, but they tended not to. Which is a little different. Okay? And we saw that there was like this general attitude that, what is this? We saw that in the debate about Shulchan Aruch. Why should you go back to what the Rabbeinu Alfasi said in the 11th century? The rabbi in the 16th century said something else. So what do I care that, I care that he said he was a great rabbi, but the rabbi in the 16th century knew about Rabbeinu Alfasi and still decided what he decided. So there should be, merit to that position. Greater merit, perhaps, for me, living in the 17th century, than to just follow what the Rif had said previously. So we saw that was an approach to Pesach. And again, we have to talk about exactly how that works a little bit more. But another position that we saw, and this was the position that seemed to be adopted by Rabbi Yosef Karo, what was his basis for making decisions? Majority rules, Rove. And you find the notion of Rove in the Torah. With this position in the Torah, it says, Achrei Rabim Lahatot, you follow the majority rule. And we find that in the Talmud. If there's a debate of the sages versus an individual rabbi, we generally follow the sages, the majority, in dealing with halakhic decisions. And so that is a position that you find sometimes in halakha. If I'm a rabbi today and I'm opening up the law books and I see seven rabbis say something is prohibited, two rabbis say something is permitted, I may tend, right, to lean towards what the seven rabbis say. Because there seems to be greater consensus about that particular position, right? So there's that kind of consideration which is taken into account when making a legal decision is going to be the numbers game. We saw there was debate about the particular number game that the Shulchan Aruch chose. Why those three? It seems a little bit random. So there's general debate about that in that instance, but there is this kind of approach, which, is sort of a shikul, a weighing of opinions that sometimes takes place. Yeah.
Majority rules, would it matter when it was written?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like a majority of anything, it depends when, who, what, where. There's a lot more, that goes into it. So maybe we'll get a little more into that in the year ahead.
Now, and isn't it also true that you don't want to lose the minority opinion because in certain circumstances
it may become appropriate. And that's right, something that we also, that's always one of the challenges of a code book, is that maybe that's not reflected then. But you'll still want that.
Something might happen that you need to do it that way, and so it's good to say you have these authorities.
Right, or the circumstances may be that you say, we need to rely on the lenient position in the other position, this position, because there's extenuating circumstances. Okay. Another approach I called here the conciliatory approach. I couldn't quite figure out which word to find to describe it. And this position you find. You can act conciliatory in two ways. You can be conciliatory to the sources or to the people, or to an individual. And depending on which one you decide to do that to, often will determine whether you will reach a chumrah or a kula, a stringency or a leniency. So, for example, let's say let's take the laws of Shabbat. You know, one rabbi says, once it gets dark, Shabbat is over. Another rabbi says, you got to wait 35 minutes. Another rabbi says, you have to wait 42 minutes. Another rabbi says, you have to wait 72 minutes. So I might be sitting here and say, you know what? Most people say 42, but there's a couple that said 72. I don't want to, you know, take the chance of being incorrect or to somehow, who am I to say that they're wrong? So you know what? Let's just say 72 minutes, and then everyone's happy. All the bases have been covered. Right? And that's a certain approach you'll find in halakha, which is the better safe than sorry approach to Jewish law. You'll sometimes find people are conciliatory in the opposite way, which is you have a person and they're sort of like the wants of society, and you'll say, well, listen, eight positions say no, one position says right, and the position that says it's okay is really the position that we want, so we're just going to say, oh, well, we have someone to rely on, and so we're going to adopt that position. So you're trying to be conciliatory to sort of the wants of society. So that's, I would say, we would say that both of those approaches are complicated, you know, have to be done carefully. It doesn't mean that they're never the correct decision to make. There'll be certain times you're going to follow a minority view. There could be the certain times that, you know, a minority view to be lenient. Sometimes you may follow a minority rule to be stringent. Depending on the circumstance, and this really gets to down to every halachic issue needs to be evaluated thoroughly and independently. You can't just set broad rules. It depends what the circumstances are. But I think we would say, generally speaking, that approach is not a good approach, right? Just, you know, finding one person says something shouldn't be a basis to permit or to prohibit anything. That seems like a little bit far-fetched. And then another approach you find, and this was really the approach that you saw reflected in the Jews of Europe at the time of the Shulchan Aruch, which was independent. Psak, I think the term they often use in Hebrew is like Ein Chacham Oseh Ela Masha Einav Ro'eh. Something like a wise person should only do what he sees with his eyes. Meaning, you should reach the conclusion that you believe is correct. Do what you believe is the appropriate conclusion. Evaluate the sources. Unless it's a situation where it's 9 versus 1, if it's 5 versus 4, and 5 say yes and 4 say no, if you think the 4 that say no are correct, so follow the 4 that say no. Meaning, it's our responsibility in each generation to evaluate the sources and reach the conclusions based on what seems to be correct. And if a rabbi of a previous generation thought differently, okay, that's what he thought that generation, but this is what we think now, and that should determine us. And so that's a certain approach you find in Psak as well. You certainly find Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was very much followed that approach. He has a lot of independent thought within his writing, a lot of novel kind of interpretations of things. And he writes in his introduction, he says, there's going to be people who are upset that I'm disagreeing with, you know, the great rabbis of the 17th and 18th century, but he says, that's not my problem. Meaning, my responsibility, my halakhic responsibility, my religious responsibility, is to do what I believe is correct. And if that's not what they thought 100 years ago, that shouldn't necessarily determine the conclusion. Again, that's a broad saying, depends on the circumstance. But as a general rule, it means we should, there should be independent thought within things. So there's all these kind of like different kind of considerations that are taken into account from relying on Psak. And you'll find in different halakhic works tend to gravitate more towards to one approach or another. Though I doubt any follows any one approach exclusively, you do find general tendencies in different works that have been written in responsa literature over the last couple hundred years in those different areas. One of the other things you find often in works of Psak are approaches of whether to be defensive or to be deterministic. And here, I referred to the idea of what if the practice is generally done within a community. And on the books, five opinions say it's really inappropriate, and four opinions say it is inappropriate. So I'm going to say, no, this is what the community has been doing for 200 years. It's a legitimate position on the books. It's not like one out of nine. It's four out of nine. You know, it's on the books. That, you know what? I'm going to defend that position. I'm saying that they have the right to continue doing Shabbat the way that they're doing Shabbat. That's sort of like, I would say, more defensive, protective kind of approach. You find that in one of the important works at the end of turn of the last century, the Aruch HaShulchan. Where he often seems to reflect that a little bit. You find a little bit of a different approach, a little bit more, what do they call it? Something from the bench? There's like some phrase where you something, where you do something, where the judge does it from the bench. He decides from the bench. I don't know, there's some like thing, whatever. I forget what that term is. Not using precedent, but he uses whatever. So in any case, which is more of a deterministic kind of approach, which you find more in the Mishnah Berurah, where there's a little bit kind of independent analysis. He'll analyze on his own what he believes to be the correct approach. And if that's not what the people are doing, then I'll say, stop doing what you're doing and follow this approach. So even though your community is maybe, you know, again, it depends on the circumstances, but it's like a general attitude, they'll feel comfortable saying, you know what, this seems to be the more compelling view or the more common view, and so this is what people should do. You know, this is the approach that people should adopt. So a little bit kind of separate from what the people are doing, but just maybe a little bit more text-focused on reaching conclusions. Mishnah Berurah, just for example, is written by the Chafetz Chaim, Yisrael Meir Kagan, who lived in Posen in Poland. His commentary, as it were, on the Shulchan Aruch only appears on one of the four books. It only appears on the books, on the book that deals with daily life. He didn't bother writing it on business transactions. So he only wrote it on this one because this is, at this point in Jewish life, the book that is more relevant to our lives. And it's become very common and in many communities authoritative writing. Mishnah Berurah says it. It's sort of like, okay, case closed. I don't know that that's necessarily has to be the case, but you certainly do find that that's a dominant kind of view. Maybe I'm not using the correct English term, but he's determining the law. He's not sort of... Yeah. Okay. Now, I just want to talk a little bit, some kind of like last historical considerations. And that's what the next section is about. And there I wrote Holocaust in Israel. So the Holocaust and the founding of the State of Israel have created... or almost concluded, I would say, in a sense, a huge shift in Jewish communities and Jewish populations. When you think of the Jewish world today, almost every single Jewish community today is not where it was 150 years ago. Right? Almost everyone has been uprooted from where they were. You think of all the communities, I would say if we went around this room, almost everyone here would say, their families did not live in America 150 years ago, right? Almost every Jew in the world, every Jewish community in the world has moved over the last 80 years and certainly over the last 150 years. What that's caused is a break with communal traditions. You know, I spoke about before, like, oh, if your community's been doing this for 100 years and it's on the books that such a position exists, so you're going to keep doing it. What if you no longer have a communal tradition? You don't remember, oh, this is the way my grandmother used to do it. You're in a different world now. You're in a different place. You're no longer in the shtetl. You're no longer in the town in Syria. The whole world has moved, right? You think of European Jewry. Totally shift. And then after the founding state of Israel, most Sephardic Jewry also had to leave. They were kicked out of their countries as well. And so There's been a huge shift. Really, one of the only communities in the world that hasn't is this community. And that's why, right, it's funny, you think of America as the new place of Jews, but in a certain sense, it's now the old place of Jews in the world. It's one of the only communities in the world where Jews have been in the same place for 300 years. That's what you'll find in our community. There are certain practices that are not commonly found elsewhere. And they probably used to be more common practices. As most other communities moved around, those practices, there ended up being a more homogenization, adopting dominant views and so on. So many of those practices have been lost. But having been in the same place for the same amount of time, they've just continued doing what they were doing before. And so you find some like really awesome. I feel like when I pray here on Shabbat, it's like I'm peering back in time to what Jews did in colonial times. It's pretty awesome. So, you know, but that's unique. You don't find that in too many places in the world today. And there's a great article, if you're interested in this topic, called Rupture and Reconstruction. Rupture and Reconstruction, written by Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, who is the son of Rabbi Soloveitchik, of blessed memory. So he wrote an article. If you do a Google search for it, you can actually probably, I think it's available online. It's a great article, and it talks about this change that's occurred, where basically once you don't have a tradition anymore to fall back on, where do you learn your traditions from? From books. And so there's been this movement towards books for figuring out what the law should be. And when you're going to go to books, then you're going to follow the dominant views. You know, you're going to go fall back on classic approaches for deciding a legal case, which means that things are going to change, that you may move more towards sometimes stringency and so on as a result of being, you don't have the permission to do what you did before because it's what you remember your mother or father are doing, because you don't know what they did anymore. So once you don't have sort of that permission, you just have to do what the book says. And tends to be, right, books will tend to go more towards a stringent kind of approach, unless you have a basis to not take that position. So that's one kind of consideration. Another thing is really the blending of communities. I mean, this is just a general issue, right? Meaning, I may come from Lithuania, right, and remember, you know, have a tradition in my family of, oh, we did or did not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Right? Sephardic practice is not to. Some Ashkenazim do, some Ashkenazim don't. But you're praying in a synagogue with Jews who come from Germany and come from Poland and come from Hungary, and everyone's doing different things. So all of a sudden you have this like blending of communities together, people doing different things, and obviously that results in like a kind of change that takes place as well, where all of a sudden, well, they're doing it. I'm gonna do it too, or, oh, you know what, I always thought that was okay, but most people in my community don't do it, so you know, I'm not going to do it either, right? But obviously you're in a community event. Place where everyone did it, you would keep doing it. So there's sort of been this molding, and not just within Ashkenazi or within Sephardi, even Ashkenazim and Sephardim together have joined to certain communities, and you'll see influences of that. I think even in our community, you know, it's unique, it's a Sephardic synagogue, but as the only synagogue in New York for 150 years, till the 1820s, if you were a Jew in New York, you were a member here. So since the early 1700s, as it is today, half the community is of Sephardic descent and half the community is of Ashkenazic descent. And I don't know for sure, I haven't evaluated all the laws, but I imagine there's certain practices in the community here which seem to be more Ashkenazi at times, maybe because there was influence. There was a lot of Ashkenazim in the community, and it influenced standing during Kaddish. Most Sephardic communities sit during Kaddish. So I don't know if I'm just guessing right now. I imagine that's kind of an Ashkenazi influence, the fact that they're standing here during Kaddish. So you're going to have those kind of influence that takes place in a mixing or a confusion of traditions because of the fact that we've all moved, but we all live amongst each other as well. And certainly, just other major consideration is we live in a new world. Our world is so profoundly different than it was 300 years ago. The Jewish community is profoundly different because of emancipation, but the world, technology, is so different than it was before, which has brought up you know, huge amounts of literature and writing to figure out how does a person be a traditional Jew in a modern world? What's the deal with electricity? There's so many things that have come up that have had to be responded to or looked at as a result of this new world in which we live. And so there's sort of, when it comes to Pesach, there's like this huge new area of things that have been discussed and continue to be spoken about. Rabbi Angel's doing a series over the summer on Shabbat afternoon about hot topics, you know, questions about organ transplantations and how do you determine the time of death. I mean, things like no one even thought about 100 years ago, you know, kind of thing. That now these are things that we think about and we look towards our tradition to say, how should it be? And what should the case be? But it's me. That's been a huge creation of literature and things to be looked at when it comes to figuring out halakha. Okay, so why don't we sort of conclude and wrap things up a little bit. We saw, just to sort of take back, we started basically with the Torah, with the Bible, and brought it to today. We saw there was a general transition that has occurred, this is more recent, from national laws to religious laws, right? Where we think of Judaism in a religious way, even though it's a nation, and we have laws that govern all aspects of our lives, but because of modern day living and emancipation and so on, and principles of the law of the land is the law, dina de mahuta dina. So because of that, there's sort of been this focus more on the more ritual, religious aspects of Judaism and less on the civil or secular aspects. And it definitely has impacted the way I think that we see what it means to be Jewish, I think is maybe like one takeaway from things that we've spoken about. But more specifically to halakha itself, we saw the challenges of writing laws. You always have the challenge. You write a law, you know, is it going to be misunderstood? Or do you incorporate other opinions? How do you incorporate other opinions with still making it a law book which is useful for someone to use? You have to understand the debates in order to really understand the law, but if you include the debates, then the law becomes hard to ascertain. And so sort of the challenges that we've seen throughout the centuries, Mishnah, Talmud, Halakhot, and so on over the years, on how do you present the law, how do you organize the law in a way that it becomes useful. Useful as a practical, but useful in that it's also really understandable in the deeper sense of being understandable. One of the things we saw is that there is almost like the cyclical nature to these books of law. Like every 100 or 200 years comes out with another major halakhic work. And that's because someone writes a halakhic work, but after that time, either there's people who disagree with something the book said, or there's just new things come up, there's new responses that have been written, and then all of a sudden there needs to be a new book which it takes into account all of those things. That hasn't happened the last 500 years. Right? Since the time of the Shulchan Aruch, that hasn't happened. Maybe we extended it for a couple hundred years by writing commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, but certainly there hasn't been a comprehensive law book written where you can look at the laws of Shabbat and the laws of organ transplantations in a code of work, and certainly one that takes into account Sephardic and Ashkenazi and so on. And not to say that there should be one way and every Jew should do it one way. It should incorporate different opinions. That's part of our tradition as well. But that there should be perhaps a code that maybe presents those things, and that hasn't really happened. I don't know that it will happen, but that would be, you know, it certainly would be. We're certainly ready. We're overdue for such a work to be compiled. And I think, as we saw, you know, it doesn't mean that when something is written, it necessarily will be adopted immediately. Shulchan Aruch was not, but you know, maybe once somebody writes it, then at least it gives it the chance. And eventually, I mean, that would, there's just so much literature now to understand the Tabu Halakha. There's so many different places you need to look, and it's hard to find those things, you know. So it certainly would be something that would be you know, worthwhile. We'll see what happens, but that's where we're at. Yeah. It was just Jewish. Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, where do they sit with all this?
Who's they?
The Reform, do they accept the
I can't. I don't want to speak for anyone else. Different communities have different relationships to halakha and law. Yeah, certainly within the conservative community, there are conservative responsa that are written as well. So there are texts that are written that can reform less so. Reform is, I think, unabashedly not a halakhic community. You know, they don't see the Judaism as binding legally. It's more values and traditions and things like that. Now, the conservative community, at least in theory, adopts a halakhic stand. How that all plays out, you know, I'll leave it there. Yeah. Everyone can evaluate on their own. But, you know, it's a challenge. Listen, we all, you know, face different questions and how we evaluate these things and whatnot. Yeah.
In addition to that, did the Hasidic communities follow like the
Again, every community is going to look towards it sort of like a start. The Hasidic community, though, certainly does not agree. Sometimes there's Kabbalistic things in the Zohar and so on that imply otherwise. So they'll go in that way. There's an important halakhic work written by Hasidim in the 18th century, written by the first Lubavitch Rebbe, which I'm sure is I haven't been in the Hasidic community. So I don't know exactly which books they use, but I'm sure, you know, again, it's a general law book which is looked at sort of a starting point, but then people go different directions, you know, with it at that point.
I thought I heard that one or two books did not accept the they didn't use the
I'm not sure.
But I read it somewhere, that's why.
Yeah. Just one comment. You know, when it comes to Orthodox conservative, there are different approaches towards Psak that have sort of developed between the communities, which make the challenge of bridging the gap a little bit difficult. There is more of a sense of within the conservative movement of the way decisions are made being to some extent more based on broader agreement and voting and the will of the people and so on that are part, meaning there'll be legal writings written by the rabbis, but then it's also there's also a body that votes on it, and it's not all halakhic authorities that are voting on it. And that's a belief that's part of the process. It should be part of the community involved in the decision. I'm not an expert in conservative law, so I can't say any of this with police certainty, but that's my general understanding. It's not just, they do the... There are differences in approaches, which present challenges, and I think those are challenges we need to face on within our community. We're all Jews, and you know, we all see our destiny as being shared, but we do things, you know, differently. And how do we still be one community while, you know, having different opinions about the way that things should be governed and the way laws should be decided, and so on. And that's I think it's an important thing to think about, you know. So it's good. It's a good question. Okay, thank you all so much. It's been great. I look forward to seeing you all. I'm going to be doing some teaching in September. I'm going to be doing a four-part class on the Book of Jonah, which we read on Kippur. So hope you'll check that out. Well, yeah, there'll be emails coming out from the synagogue and so on, and then and sign up for class. So the class, you know, be in touch in a week. Or something, and you know,
would it be okay if I took a copy?